I think MicroStrategy is a great option. I actually believe it's the only asset that I've seen so far that can outperform Bitcoin over the long term, 10, 15, 20 years from now. I think that the valuations on tons of companies, there's going to be lots of new businesses that we can't even imagine right now that are going to be out. They probably actually might be worth investing in and actually parting with some of your Bitcoin, because I think the CAGR, compound annual growth rate of Bitcoin, 15, 20 years from now, will have come down enough. A lot of moon boys want to talk about exponential growth. They want to talk about parabolic moves to the moon. But what you'll notice with Bitcoin is every time it goes parabolic, and it has several times in its short history, it breaks down. Parabolic moves are unsustainable even in Bitcoin. And I would say that it's a sign of actual health that it's following a power law model. I'm a physician, I'm a radiologist. So what I do is I look at patterns inside of people, and then I look for patterns of disease within the healthy patterns and what that all means, and create reports. I do the same thing in finance too. And I think Bitcoin is actually pretty amazing.
This podcast is entertainment, not financial, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed represent statements of the speaker in their individual capacity, do not represent the views of Unchained, and should not be considered investment advice. Speakers often have personal, family, or business connections to Unchained, which may include direct financial benefits. Please see our disclosure at unchained.com/podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Bitcoin Frontier podcast. This week, I have on Dr. Jeff Ross. Welcome.
Hey, Joe. Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, glad to have you. Let's start off with some macro talk. I mean, right now we've seen the Fed walking back potential rate cuts. We saw the, you know, VIX hit a year-to-date high recently, and inflation's been hotter than expected. What are you thinking about right now from a macro perspective and a Bitcoin perspective?
Sure. So I feel like I'm a bit of a I'm getting long in the tooth because I keep saying the same thing, and I've been saying it for a few quarters now. I call this the bull crab market, and I think we're still in this bull crab market. I think you mentioned that inflation came in a little hotter than expected. I would say maybe the markets expected it to be a little lower, but I just expect that this is going to continue on for the foreseeable future. And so what do I mean? Inflation, I think, is in a new regime now. I don't think we're going back to the days of sub 2% inflation. So people who think that, I think, are going to continue to be disappointed. You know, that obviously relates to what's happening with treasury yields, right? If we think that treasuries are related to basically future growth and inflation expectations, we shouldn't expect yields to fall much going forward as well. If inflation remains high, kind of in the maybe 2-4% level for who knows how long, at least the foreseeable future, and if we still see some reasonable, maybe not awesome, but okay, U.S. economic growth, then we should expect treasury yields to kind of be in the same range. And I think that's what they're reflecting. People are making big deals about these moves, like in the 10-year from maybe 4.5 to maybe it's going to get up to 5. Who knows? I think if it does, it's just going to kind of fall back down again. And it's going to continue to zigzag. I like to call it the crab markets, where things just sort of chop sideways. It's kind of a boring market. It's a rough market to be in. I equate it to treading water, where you're just not really doing anything but just sitting there, you know, not staying in one spot. And so people want to see action, right? They want to see risk assets moving. The only real action we've seen, I think, in the markets that I look at are commodities, and commodities are linked to inflation. So we've seen oil catch a nice bid, related commodities, even gold has caught a bit of a bid recently. Bitcoin has got a short-term bid, but I still think it's all kind of within normal limits for this crab market range. People ask me a lot, and just so people know, I haven't been on the show for a while. I think of the markets in terms of five things. So three main categories. I think of a bear market, a crab sideways market, and a bull market. And then I have my little in-between. So between a bear and a crab market is the bear crab market. And between a crab and a bull market is the bull crab market. So they usually go in that order from bottom of the bear market up. And we've ascended all the way up to this bull crab market where we've been sitting. And I do think at some point, probably this summer somewhere, maybe it's late spring, summer, early fall, that will actually finally get to the next notch and go up to the bull market. And I think that's when the excitement starts. That's when liquidity serves. And from a macro standpoint, liquidity serves as actually a tailwind. Or, you know, if you get your treading water analogy, now suddenly the current is really moving and you're getting pushed along, and risk assets tend to do really well, and Bitcoin does even better. So that's sort of how I look at it. That's my general 30,000 foot overview.
I like it. What do you think the catalyst for transitioning from the bull crab market to more of a full on bull market would be? Was it just a matter of time, or is there something else?
So If you would have asked me this a year ago, I would have said that we were heading into a recession and that we're going to have a basically a deflationary bust and the Fed is going to be forced to pivot and just do massive QE, kind of similar to what they've done in the past with the COVID response and back in 2008, 2009, that time period. I was expecting that to happen. What I didn't expect to happen was this huge fiscal stimulus from the other side of the government, you know, across the street. So that's what I would have expected. I don't think that's going to happen anymore. I don't think, despite a lot of doom and gloomers still posting out there for whatever reason, they tend to be Gen Xers. I'm a Gen Xer too, so I can say that a lot of Gen Xers are just really doomy and gloomy, and they continue to call for a pending recession. I just don't think that's coming in the near future. I do believe it's been kicked down. The can has been kicked down the road probably until 2025 or 2026. What would cause this to happen? I think liquidity could get a boost basically because the economy, I believe, has bottomed and is slowly starting to chug again. As that happens, banks start lending again. M2 money supply starts increasing. Credit starts expanding. That is what in general acts as a tailwind, and people can move further out onto the risk curve as more and more people believe that we're actually not going to fall into a recession, that we are seeing an expansionary business environment, and that tends to be good. So that's what I'm waiting for. I don't think we're going to have any major event. We could, right? We could get an announcement tonight that we're going into World War III, possibly. Yeah, that tends to spook the markets. I still don't believe that until it happens. So once it does happen, I'll change my mind. But until that happens, like, I'm going to continue to act like it's not going to happen and go with what the markets are telling me. So markets are all pointing upwards. I think that's where we eventually start to see as that starts to kick in, as banks start to lend again, as the economies gain strength, liquidity should start to increase. The global M2 money supply should start to increase. And I think that will serve as a tailwind for risk assets, and especially for Bitcoin.
As that starts to happen in Bitcoin does go into a potential bull market at some point down the line, how do you think about analyzing, like, the, you know, where Bitcoin will go during the cycle? Like, we've had talks before, not us, but people on Twitter and whatnot, talking about the stock to flow model or the power law model and using that as like a gauge of where Bitcoin might go. How do you think about, like, what might be the cycle top this cycle?
Sure. So I'm a big believer in patterns and pattern recognition. Part of it is, you know, is sort of how I'm wired in my other life. You can see behind me these monitors here. I'm a physician. I'm a radiologist. So what I do is I look at patterns inside of people, and then I look for patterns of disease within the healthy patterns and what that all means, and create reports. I do the same thing in finance too. And I think Bitcoin is actually pretty amazing, mainly because I couldn't wrap my head around for many years that Bitcoin in and of itself is a mathematical concept and a mathematical construct. It actually is this mathematical pattern within the setting of macroeconomics and within the setting of the world of finance. Other asset classes have sort of patterns, but not nearly as repetitive as Bitcoin has, at least to date, right? So we're 15 years into Bitcoin. I believe that these patterns where we have basically these four-year cycles, where we have this generally parabolic move higher, followed by a large bust, followed by this crabby, choppy, sideways, slightly higher price movement, I think it's going to continue. And I think I've been in Bitcoin since about 2015, 2016. So I've been watching this since then. And I have always been amazed by how there is this sort of mathematical quality to it. Like, something is up, something's fishy. It's hard to explain why, but it definitely does it, right? So the way I look at things as a fund manager and just individually, for my own personal finances and family finances, I think that the Bitcoin pattern of these sort of boom, bust, and then trend choppy sideways, higher price action is going to continue until the pattern breaks. There are many models that people talk about. There are many Bitcoiners who get extremely agitated when people talk about models. You know, everything changed the day that Michael Saylor said all your models are broken, because now if you even suggest that you believe in any kind of a model, you're crazy because you disagree with Michael Saylor. That's sort of the general popular theory. I don't agree with that necessarily. I think Bitcoin does follow a pattern. And so I'm coming full circle here. I don't think that the stock to flow model is going to continue to hold. I think this is the first cycle where we see it basically break. It may get up to that level. I believe that model says something like a 600 or 650,000 new baseline price target. It's possible we get up and touch that, but then I think we descend back far below that and we don't have that kind of baseline way up at that level. Lots of very intelligent people disagree with me, by the way, so I have to have this caveat. This is just my personal beliefs. This is not individual investment advice. I think by two cycles further, so let's call it 8 years from now, I think the stock to flow model will be proven just to be completely false and people won't really pay much attention to it. That's just my opinion. I do think that it follows this logarithmic growth curve. This is very controversial right now. I have many friends, good friends, who are way smarter than me in the Bitcoin space, dear friends, who really strongly don't believe in this model. I think it's kind of shocking. And maybe this is because I'm sort of autistic and I'm kind of I'm a doctor. I'm sort of scientific. To me, it's just very clearly following power law model. I don't even think there's any way you can disagree with this. Now, what people can get contentious about is, will it continue to do this going forward, right? So I say for the first 15 years, it clearly is following a logarithmic power law growth curve. Clearly not parabolic like this. It's clearly up and over sort of that rainbow chart that people think of. That's a classic power law growth pattern. Will it continue? Nobody knows. That's the point of contention. We don't know. I say as a proponent of this and as a believer in this, that yes, this will continue going on in the future. I think we will be able to count on a similar pattern 10, 20, 30, 40 years into the future. And lots of people disagree with that. That's totally fine. It may break that. I say again, I believe that this model will be accurate until it's not accurate. So it could break to the downside. It could break to the upside. At that point, I'll reassess. I'll try to stay humble, reconfigure the way I think about the world and think about Bitcoin, and I'll change at that point. But until it breaks, I'm sticking with that model. It was a really long answer. Sorry, but that's how I view it.
No, that was really good. I definitely wanted to hear your perspective on it. I don't think I've heard you talk about the models quite yet.
Can I elaborate just one more thing? Because I think it's an important point. A lot of people get disappointed by this because a lot of moon boys want to talk about exponential growth. They want to talk about parabolic moves to the moon. But what you'll notice with Bitcoin is every time it goes parabolic, and it has several times in its short history, it breaks down. Parabolic moves are unsustainable even in Bitcoin. And I would say that it's a sign of actual health that it's following a power law model. A power law model means it's sustainable over very long periods of time. And I would suggest it's sustainable indefinitely versus what happens with exponential growth when you get that parabolic move higher. At some point, the growth of whatever entity we're talking about, whether it's an infection like a virus or bacteria, or if it's a human population or some sort of creature in the sea, who knows what we're talking about, whatever it is, or cancer, if it grows too fast for too long, it uses up all of the resources and it destroys the host.
In this frontier moment, Dr. Jeff is discussing the unsustainable exponential growth seen in cancer cells. Another less familiar example of unsustainable growth is ecological invasions. The kudzu vine in the southern United States grows rapidly, overwhelming local ecosystems and outcompeting native species, just like cancer cells. Connecting this to markets, similar patterns are seen in Bitcoin cycles. During bull markets, the rapid inflow of buyers often leads to overextensions that the market cannot sustain, resulting in inevitable and often steep corrections or bear markets that can last 12 to 18 months. And now back to Dr. Jeff.
And so I think that's the same for Bitcoin. Bitcoin is using this ever-increasing amount of energy. If it were to go continuously parabolic, at some point it would take up all the energy that the earth and that humanity can provide for it, and it would basically kill itself. It would die out because of that. Because we have this power law growth, which is more smooth, even though there are bumps along the way, that is this sustainable growth that humanity can continue to maintain. And we can continue to create energy and find cheaper and cheaper and more powerful energy sources throughout our history, I believe. And that's why I think Bitcoin is sustainable for not just years, but decades, centuries, and probably millennia.
Wow, that's very interesting. So basically, with your past career, you've learned that there are various patterns that are actually parabolic and exponential are bad eventually, or most likely bad. And the power law model is actually like sustainable growth. That's
exactly what it's true saying. Sustainable growth. Exactly.
Very cool. Huh. Do you have any other examples from your past career, or like I know you brought up, you mentioned cancer, virus, Like, is there any more that you can elaborate on, or is that just like the general?
Well, though, another one that's not medical related, but proof of stake crypto nonsense, right? I mean, what they do is they rip higher and everybody gets all excited and marketing and VC money and everything is behind them. It goes up. I compare them to like lighting a match. It flares up and gets super hot and everybody gets jacked about it. And then it crashes down. And we've seen that pattern happen in proof of stake cryptocurrencies for as long as I've been in this space, since about 2015, 2016. And I think that will continue. There are a couple outliers, which I don't really want to talk about, but for the other 30,000 of them, that's what they do. If they get any attention at all, they go exponential and then they crash because they just have used up all the resources, all the people who believe in them, the network effects. It can only go so far. I compare, you know, proof of stake crypto to like intranets. They only have so much expansion that they can do within the company of that intranet. And then it eventually peaks and then people lose interest and it wipes out and heads towards zero.
Yeah, very interesting. It's crazy. So I guess if this cycle occurs and Bitcoin does go on like a short-term exponential function and then eventually crashes, how would you go about identifying when the top might be? Would it be like a specific price? Would there be other patterns or indications that you'd be looking at?
This is supposed to be taboo in all of finance. And I've always been one to call out people who do this. You're not supposed to be able to put price targets with date targets, right? You can pick one or the other. You can say that I think, you know, maybe the price target of Apple stock is going to go up to $300, but you probably shouldn't pick a time because you're going to be way off, even though you might eventually be right. And then vice versa. Again, and this, I'm going to get a lot of crap for this, and I apologize to any listeners who disagree with this, but I think you can actually, based on past cycles, get pretty particular in things like actual price targets and actual time date targets. So the way I look at it, I've been saying for quite a while now, maybe over a year or more, that I think the price target for Bitcoin at the end of its parabolic move will be sometime probably in the fourth quarter of 2025. And I think it's going to be 475,000-ish. And that may prove to be conservative. So if it shoots a lot higher temporarily, I'm not going to be like, oh my goodness, I'm so far off. It hit a million and I said 475. I'll just be like, well, yeah, okay, that's possible. These kind of things can happen. But I will tell you, and this is what's going to happen, is I'll be on X and I'll be in some spaces or doing some interview. And I'm going to get really unpopular again because I'm going to say this parabolic growth is unsustainable. This is not how Bitcoin works. You know, do what you want. And I'm not saying that anybody should ever sell their Bitcoin or do whatever, you know, I'm not making any individual recommendations, but you cannot sustain parabolic growth. So at that point, I would say be very careful, because most likely we're going to see a really large pullback again, and we're going to have a very long, a very painful bear market that will probably, if it's based on past cycles, last about a year. So I would say probably fourth quarter of 2026, we're probably going to be around the low, just like previous cycles. So again, just a prediction, just a guess. Until the pattern changes, that's what I'm going to hold to. If the pattern breaks clearly in one direction, I'll change my mind at that point. But that's what I'm holding on to for now.
Yeah, I tend to agree that the cycles will probably continue. I want to talk a little bit about your hedge fund. I saw you posted on Twitter the other day, or X, that it was the best performing hedge fund of 2024 so far. Can you explain, you know, what your strategy is and how you've done it?
You know, I want to tell people, like, I don't say this to flex at all, right? I'm just some schmuck sitting in Colorado just doing the best I can. This is like all kudos to Bitcoin, right? Like, Bitcoin is the winning team. And I just continue to tell people, especially my colleagues in traditional finance, get on board with Bitcoin, like jump on the winning team. That's literally all you got to do. I like to use the analogy of, say it's a football team and you might not be the starting quarterback or a star wide receiver or even a lineman. You might just be the water boy or you might be a cheerleader for the team. But as long as you're on the winning team, you get the benefits of being on the winning team. If your winning team wins the Super Bowl and you're riding the bench as the worst player on the team, you still get a Super Bowl ring, right? So coming full circle, my fund, yeah, go figure. Preqin, who is a huge hedge fund database and based out of London, they just emailed me and said, hey, by the way, just so you know, your fund did the best out of every fund in the entire world for the first 3 months of 2024. I was a little surprised. I knew we did well. But so net of fees, we had a pretty nice return. And again, this is it's unaudited stuff. I got to be careful. All this kind of stuff I say, right? I'm not soliciting my fund at all to anybody. I think most people should just simply invest in Bitcoin and forget about it. But I tell people, this is what you need to be doing in traditional finance. If you're still skeptical and still sitting on the sidelines with Bitcoin, just put a little bit in your portfolio and see what it can do for you, especially over the next 18 months. If they're anything like past cycles, and again, past performance is not indicative of future returns, but if it were to be, this would be the time to consider some kind of meaningful investment in Bitcoin within your portfolio.
Nice. Yeah, I agree with that. Did the fund outperform Bitcoin? I didn't actually do the calculation.
So net of fees, we were, and again, unaudited, according to Preqin, we had about an 83% return for the first 3 months. And I believe Bitcoin was 69% or 70, somewhere right around there. So yeah, we did. And again, that's because we don't just invest. I do have just some straight up Bitcoin exposure, but we also have Bitcoin proxies. I use options as well. We also have nonsense things like, other stocks. We have debt instruments as well. So they actually just act as an anchor. I think of Bitcoin like a speedboat. And then we put these other stocks and this fixed income in there. And it's like throwing anchors out of your boat and they're dragging behind your speedboat while you're trying to go. Just for the sake of diversification, we hold a lot of those as well.
Does the fund hold any like MicroStrategy or is it most? Okay, nice.
So we do have Bitcoin proxies. Yeah. So MicroStrategy. And then we also have Bitcoin miners and things like that. And then I like the proxies, even like, Square, which is Block Now, Jack Dorsey's company. I like companies that are Bitcoin focused and have, a Bitcoin initiative as well. I tend to favor those equities over more traditional equities.
Are there like specific metrics that you use when making decisions to evaluate like which, Bitcoin proxies or which options or which miners to include in your fund?
So I roughly categorize it this way, right? So Bitcoin, I think, is just the king of assets. It's an awesome asset. You want to have Bitcoin. I think for most people, the vast majority of people, just dollar cost average into Bitcoin, put it into cold storage and forget about it. And the price will take care of itself. And you're going to outperform 99% of anyone else in the finance world who doesn't hold Bitcoin. So that's Bitcoin. I think of as a manager, how could I possibly do better than Bitcoin itself? How could I, maybe not lose as less and possibly gain more during a bull market? So if you do that, you have to think in terms of beta. You think of assets that go in the same direction as Bitcoin, but maybe with more severity during a bull market, and then maybe avoid those in a bear market. A great proxy is Bitcoin miners. They tend to act just as basically beta to Bitcoin. So when Bitcoin goes up in a bull market, lots of miners tend to go up even more. They're really volatile. I don't recommend them for anybody. I don't recommend, by the way, Bitcoin miners as a long-term holding. I think of those as a trade. They're a good bull market trade or possibly a short during a bear market. That's all I'll say. I'm not recommending anything like that. That's how I feel about miners in general. And there are ways I have little personal things I metrics I use to try to distinguish the good miners from maybe the more dicey miners. I will tell people that Bitcoin mining is a terrible business. It's a dog eat dog business. It is really competitive, right? You can be a star miner 1 year and then suddenly a new miner comes out that is more efficient, that it can create more hash, that it uses less energy, all that kind of stuff. You may be a miner that's in a great spot, and then suddenly your government comes against you and says, you can't have that energy source we promised you before, and suddenly you're all shut off. There's lots of things that can happen to miners. You could have a great setup for miners, and then a terrible operator. Maybe the CEO is a buffoon, or just makes a really unlucky decision. We saw that in the last cycle where people took a ton of debt out right near the top of the cycle, and then they got wiped out in the bear market. That kind of stuff happens. That's why I generally don't recommend these as long-term holdings. Just buy Bitcoin, put it in cold storage. That's all I'll say about miners, Bitcoin, and then I have MicroStrategy as a totally separate category. I think of MicroStrategy not just as beta to Bitcoin, which it clearly is, but I think of it as smart beta. I've said this regularly that I think investing with Michael Saylor and MicroStrategy today is similar to investing with Warren Buffett back in the 1970s when he was kind of just first getting his start and was the star hedge fund manager back in the day. Why? Because I think he's a master capital allocator. Very few people understand Bitcoin like he does. And he straddles the world of traditional finance and the dollar-based system and Bitcoin. So what he can do, and I think this is brilliant, he's been doing it for years, and he literally has this open playbook for the whole world to see. When his stock gets really expensive, he can sell more shares of it and take the proceeds and buy Bitcoin. If interest rates are really low, he can issue debt from his company, access the public markets or private markets, and issue debt, get more money, and buy more Bitcoin. He can play Bitcoin off of each other. When MicroStrategy gets too cheap or too expensive relative to the price of Bitcoin, there are tools you can do that are totally legal and totally fine. There's nothing like sketchy at all about what he's doing. And he's very wide open about it. And you can do things to boost the amount of Bitcoin on your balance sheet. And if people are going to give you basically free money, right? I think his latest things was he issued debt for like 0.75% to 0.82% or somewhere in there, which if you factor in inflation, he's basically getting free money. In fact, he's getting almost paid, you could argue, in fiat terms to buy Bitcoin on the cheap. And if you have that point of view and the conviction that he has and the willingness to sit out the volatility of Bitcoin, there's almost no way you can lose. And so even though I recommend people, my only recommendation people to people formally is to buy Bitcoin, put it in cold storage. If people want to get out into the brokerage land and, you know, and they have a brokerage account and maybe they can't buy Bitcoin in there or something, I think MicroStrategy is a great option. I actually believe it's the only asset that I've seen so far that can outperform Bitcoin over the long term. I think as long as Saylor is at the helm, I think as long as the government doesn't jump in and try to stop him, which could happen, you know, there are risks as long as, you know, there's custodial risks. So something could happen to one of the custodians. We just don't know. There are tons of different risks versus just owning Bitcoin in cold storage. Assuming none of that stuff happens, I think that MicroStrategy could continue to outperform Bitcoin, not just like on a yearly basis, but a multi-year, even a decade-long basis. And then the last thing I'll say about MicroStrategy, again, tons of risks, not recommending it. But I do think, and I've said that I actually tweeted this, I want to say a year and a half or 2 years ago, that I think MicroStrategy by the year 2033 will be the largest company by market cap in the world. And I had people just mocking me when I said that. I mean, it was not even in the top 500 back then, and now it's in the 300. So it's rising quickly. I just don't see how they can't be. I mean, if you're doing this speculative arbitrage, taking cheap dollars and buying Bitcoin with it and then riding the price of Bitcoin appreciation and having leverage-based returns on Bitcoin, I don't know how it can't be the largest company by 2033. So that's just my guess. I'll probably be wrong, but I don't think I'll be that far off, honestly, if I am wrong.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, it's like either someone much larger than MicroStrategy is going to like copy their strategy and try to get more Bitcoin than them, or if it just no one copies him for a while, then he'll probably just massively outperform everyone.
The first mover advantage is gigantic in Bitcoin, even from a country's perspective. Even watching it, what El Salvador is doing, they're just this little unknown, you know, country that's just making all the right moves early on, and so it's fascinating to watch. And that's another thing. I don't know if we should even dip into that, but I think Bitcoin changes the geopolitical world order in a meaningful way. You know, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the sovereign individual, that whole concept, but I think that history tends to move in these sort of 500 to 1,000 year blocks or cycles. And I think that we have had this transition, a clear transition from the analog age to the digital age, you know, the microprocessor, internet, and now Bitcoin, which is the internet of value age. And I think it has geopolitical implications. Most of the traditional finance people that I follow still believe in the ascendancy of China and the descendancy of the US, and that it's setting up to have this a lot of tensions and things. The dark horse is Bitcoin, literally coming out of nowhere. And I think it's going to just change everything. And so anyways, that's a whole different topic and we don't have to go down that route. But
let's dive into it a little bit. Okay. Since you brought it up, because it is very interesting. I mean, how do you think that the world will change? And why do you think that China might not be a global superpower that a lot of people might expect?
Sure. So I think it's definitely on the path to become one in many ways. And it's following the playbook, right? It's like literally looking at history and looking at France and the Netherlands, and it's looking at England, and it's looking at the US and looking at all these great countries from the past, Spain, saying, okay, here's what you got to do. You need to stockpile assets, especially gold, and in these days, like oil. So let's get some hard assets. And then we're going to build a sound money based on these assets. And while these other countries are awash in their own debt, like the United States is, and these massive debt to, you know, to GDP ratios, they can't help but decline because of that. And so we're going to come in with this sound commodity-based currency, and we're going to come in and ascend, you know, and it follows. And Ray Dalio goes into this at length and talks about the kind of rise and falls of these huge sovereign nations. Why is it changing? I think because of the whole decentralization movement. So because of the internet and because of Bitcoin, basically people are able to spread the power out. So what we have seen, I think, in the US, I think will go down in history as the peak of monolithic power. They had the hugest, largest, most unassailable monopoly on violence that the world has ever seen. So they can control the world, like literally the flows of the world, geopolitical flows, economic flows. You know, they own the nation, they own the navies of the world. They control the movements in the seas and commerce and all this kind of stuff. They still do, but it's starting to come apart a little bit. And we're trying to maintain that status on borrowed money. These other nations, the BRICS nations, have caught on to that. I think they caught on about 10 years ago and have started making changes. And the easiest one is they're not buying treasuries really anymore, and they're stockpiling gold and oil. Smart move, I would say. In the old playbook, that's a smart move. But I think what they're not recognizing and what all of these countries are missing literally is Bitcoin and the whole concept of decentralization. When you don't control the printing press anymore, you don't have the power. Whoever controls the creation and distribution of money literally has the most power. If you have the most monetary units and the creation and distribution of it, like the US does, even though it's starting to wane, you have just almost unlimited power. As more and more humans take that purchasing power out of these fiat systems and into Bitcoin, it goes into this distributed network. I think of it like this meshwork that basically envelops the earth. And that benefits humans at the expense of the government. So while government's trying to draw your purchasing power into them and to get bigger and stronger ever more, which is what the US has done a great job doing over the last 80 years or so, Bitcoin is basically sucking that back out and distributing it back out to the people. So I think we're just going to see an entirely different geopolitical world. The whole world order is going to look differently because we're not going to see centralized monoliths of power that have the ability to destroy the entire world, you know, because of their nuclear arsenals or whatever means that they have. Bitcoin, I think, and this is a, you know, Jason Lowry is people love to hate him. He has, you know, popular and unpopular opinions. I think he's right with this. Like the way that the geopolitical world order has held for the last five centuries is mutually assured destruction, right? And I think Bitcoin changes that. Basically, it's that mutually assured preservation that Bitcoin causes. Basically, it's like, you can't get my Bitcoin and my value and our net worth and our purchasing power, but we can't get yours either. And so it sort of creates these natural barriers. And there's really no reason to go attack another nation if we can't get their value and give it to ourselves. It's not possible technically.
This episode is sponsored by Sound Advisory, an Unchained affiliate. If you can't talk about your Bitcoin wealth with your financial advisor, it might be time to find a new advisor. Sound Advisory is a leading financial advisory firm for long-term Bitcoin holders like yourself. If you need help optimizing taxes, establishing goals, creating a distribution plan for Bitcoin wealth, or designing estate and inheritance plans, then check out Sound Advisory at thesoundadvisory.com for more information. That's thesoundadvisory.com. Now back to the show.
And so that's something that Bitcoin does. I think it actually has the possibility to usher in basically multiple centuries of peace, which is surprising, especially for those of us who grew up, you know, with grandparents and great grandparents that were involved in these world wars. We all thought the world was going to end and that World War III was coming, and that at some point nukes were going to go off and, you know, we had the potential to blow up most or all of the world. I think Bitcoin is literally able to change that. And it's because of that distribution of power and that mutually assured preservation throughout the world.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I definitely think Bitcoin leaves room for optimism for the world and for humanity. So I think it's a great thing. Hopefully we're right about that.
Definitely.
I kind of want to talk a little bit about like individual portfolio construction, like thinking about wealth from just a normal person's perspective, and obviously not financial advice or anything, but how do you think that someone should think about their Bitcoin allocation and their personal portfolio?
It's a good question. So, you know, I've been doing this for this is my 11th year now of managing other people's money and running a hedge fund. It's very different for everybody. And I tell people regarding Bitcoin, they all want to know, like, what's the right percentage? And I tell people, the more you understand Bitcoin, the more you know Bitcoin, the more Bitcoin you will own. And that's been true basically across the board for many, many years. I've seen people do that. So people start with, right, I see there's four phases of Bitcoin understanding. The initial one is basically skepticism. You mock it. You don't believe it. You think it's for crazy people. You believe all the FUD that you see in the newspapers and all that kind of stuff. The second is you finally kind of come around and you see all these people making money and getting wealthier. So you turn into a speculator, right? So you start thinking of it like a trade. It's all the crypto bros are kind of in that category. Like they just think, oh, when do I get in? When do I get out? And I'm going to, you know, take my profits here and blah, blah, blah. And then you go a step further, step three. I think is you see Bitcoin as either an investment or a hedge. So like just an investment in general, and that's kind of how Wall Street has started to understand it. Like it's an actual asset class that you could invest in. And I think the SEC approval of the spot Bitcoin ETF sort of confirmed that. So lots of Wall Streeters are starting to see this, and even baby boomers are seeing this as an alternative asset class that's a new asset class to invest in. Lots of other people talk about it as a hedge too. I think of that in that same third category. You know, the traditional fiat system the Keynesian economic system is getting really precarious. Debt is getting out of control. We're starting to see nations have real issues. People are struggling with inflation. The cost of goods and services are really increasing. Bitcoin is a hedge. It's an alternative system to the fiat system in case it explodes and dies or implodes or whatever happens to a fiat system when it dies, especially the US-based huge economic system. At least I have Bitcoin as a hedge in case it does, like kind of like gold, they think of it. And then fourth and final, I think you see Bitcoin as superior savings technology. So I tell people like, yeah, I get asked all the time, like, well, when are you going to take profits? So, you know, we talked earlier about these parabolic move higher. Like, what if Bitcoin gets up to 400,000 or five? Like, are you going to take profits then? And it's just like, I think when you think of Bitcoin as savings, it's really funny. Nobody ever comes up to me and says, hey, when are you going to take profits on your bank savings account? You're just like, what are you even talking about, right? It's just my cash in the bank. Like I use that to pay my bills and to, you know, if I need to buy a car or something or go on a vacation, that's what I use my savings for. And so I think of Bitcoin as the same way. Not only is it like a bank savings account, which ironically is where your purchasing power goes to die, it's superior savings technology. It's appreciating store of value and it appreciates your purchasing power. So I would argue that most people would be wise to think of it like Michael Saylor does. You just buy it. It's the king of assets. Like, what are you going to exchange it for? Like, even if you do make a good trade, there's a good chance you'll time it wrong. You'll get taxed a bunch. You could lose something and you'll end up with less Bitcoin than you did if you would have just, you know, kept your head down and stacked sats and put it into cold storage, like a humble pleb. So I can't even remember the original question, but the amount of Bitcoin in a portfolio, it depends on the person. And I will say that what I've seen is people get off zero. That's the biggest move. Just get off 0%, have some sort of Bitcoin allocation. And when you see the effects that that has on your portfolio, that it's not nearly as scary as you thought it was going to be, and you're seeing some pretty nice portfolio gains because of it, people start to increase it. And then as you study Bitcoin itself and the network itself and the monetary properties and this scheduled halvings and all of these things that are just amazing about Bitcoin, you start to realize that it's not even risky. Like all the FUD that people talk about is really unlikely to happen, right? The governments aren't going to shut it down. It's not like boiling the oceans. It's all this kind of crazy things that people talk about doesn't actually ever really come to pass. And so you realize that the real risk in finance is not volatility, even though that's what people associate with risk. That's what they teach you in your MBA finance courses. Real risk, I would argue, is the chance of losing your purchasing power over time in a given asset. So I would argue that even though the 10-year treasury is considered the world's risk-free asset, that it actually is exceedingly risky because you're almost guaranteed to lose your purchasing power if you hold it for the 10-year duration. That's risky. If you have less purchasing power 10 years from now, you did something wrong, I would argue. And Bitcoin does the opposite of that. So even though it's volatile, I think it's very unrisky.
Is there ever a scenario where you have a client that you would advise them not to buy Bitcoin, or does that not exist at all?
I try to tell all of my clients to have at least some Bitcoin. When I filter new clients, it used to be I would kind of accept whoever wants to come. Now I tend to filter my clients much more closely, and I make sure that they're at least okay with some Bitcoin allocation. My very, you know, most conservative clients, we still have at least a little bit of a Bitcoin allocation because I just think it's imperative, and I think it's just foolish not to. There are some people who just disagree with me, right? There are some people who believe the FUD. They haven't done their homework. They just disagree. We tend to part ways. And that's how I think is the best way to do it. I believe so strongly in it that people should have at least some exposure to it, that people who don't want to have exposure, I just think, you know, you're going to find a better advisor somewhere who meets your needs much more than I will. And we're going to kind of clash in our ideology too much. So that's what I think about. I think it's literally, even though this isn't written yet in the regulatory annals of the RIA world, that I think it's actually fiduciary fiduciary responsibility to have people in Bitcoin, even if the world doesn't agree with me. I've thought this since 2019 and 2020, even when it was exceedingly unpopular, even when there was career risk. I just think, look, you guys just don't get it. And I know that the world will catch on and the world is starting to catch on. And so I think it's actually irresponsible to not have at least some Bitcoin in your portfolio.
I definitely agree with that. When you think about like a financial advisor, like your job is to somewhat like manage wealth and manage your investments and like obviously get returns on their portfolio. In like a world where clients just have a lot of Bitcoin as a large portion of their portfolio, how important do you think investment management is? Does it get less important? Does it get more important?
I think it gets less important personally. I mean, I truly believe you can do very well just on a Bitcoin standard. And when I have clients who are at that point where they have, say, over half of their net worth in Bitcoin, I'll just tell them like, you don't need me. Like you don't need any financial advisor. Like just go keep stacking sats. And as long as you're comfortable with that and you're comfortable with the volatility and you understand the risks associated with that, and you have, you know, enough cash to pay your bills, depending on where you live and to deal with tax consequences and all that kind of stuff, just go with it. Even me personally, I spend my days figuring out how to manage my client portfolios and my hedge fund. But personally, I just stack sats and I don't care. I'm not over there trading it, you know, and trying to make all these crazy profits and whatever, you know, time the markets. I'm just stack sats. When I get extra cash from my work, I like almost instantly go and buy Bitcoin with it. And for people who are at that same level as I am, I'd recommend the same thing.
When it comes to your clients or some of your clients and you're talking to them about like, how do you actually hold Bitcoin? Like, how do you explain or suggest whether like you should buy an ETF, whether you should hold it on Coinbase or whether you should do collaborative custody or self-custody? Like, how do you think about that?
So I always tell people that the best way to do it is to simply, you know, to buy Bitcoin at an exchange and then put it into cold storage. And then I talk about the differences between, you know, like a multi-sig solution versus keeping it in a, you know, maybe an insured account at some other exchange, things like that. I talk a lot about, you know, the benefits of Bitcoin aren't just price appreciation. Most people, that's all they care about. Those kind of people, they tend to be attracted to the Bitcoin spot ETFs. And they should be. That's kind of an easy way for them to get exposure with a click of a button. It's very convenient to own that. But they're missing out on the whole point of Bitcoin, which is this, you know, it's this decentralized, scarce, permissionless money. And you don't have any of those qualities if you're buying ETFs. You can't just move your money around if you want to, you know, without a trusted third party or an intermediary. So we go about that. I don't quibble too much with people when they're first getting into the space. Bitcoin is intriguing enough that when you have these great price appreciations, it tends to encourage people to learn more about it over time. So I think a pretty easy first step is to get them into a spot Bitcoin ETF. And then as they learn about it and they own it for a couple of years and they see how, you know, it's done so differently and performed so well relative to these other asset classes, depending on when they get in, they usually start doing the work at that point. And then that's when I encourage them to get over. And I am always just kind of poking people like, hey, you got to make sure that you have Bitcoin in cold storage. You got to, you know, think about what will you do if you die? What will you do if you lose your seed phrase? You know, have you thought about multi-sig? I like having those conversations with people, but they need to be a little bit more advanced. You know, if I'm talking to a boomer who is just getting their first exposure to Bitcoin, they're often very confused. They don't even know what I'm talking about half the time. And you really lose them and their eyes glaze over when you start talking about all these kind of things. So they just want to like preserve their capital and make money. And Bitcoin does that too, even though that's just kind of the most superficial aspect of Bitcoin.
Do you think there's a role at all in the future where like financial advisors play a role in like private key management? Like I think of, you know, Unchained, they hold one key and as an individual, you can hold two keys. And then we also have like the Peter Dunworth Bitcoin advisor model where like Unchained may hold a key, the Peter Dunworth or the Bitcoin advisors may hold a key and the client may hold a key. Do you think that that's going to be a like growing segment for financial advisors?
I do think so. Although I don't think it will be huge growth. I think as long as we have kind of this other system, the trusted system, basically the traditional fiat system, that's going to take a lot of people. It's so easy to do that. And it's so easy to just for people to trust, you know, BlackRock or trust Fidelity to basically act as a custodian and to simply just do one click and you're done and not really think about it. It's easy from tax perspectives, all that kind of stuff. it's almost like two totally different types of people who get into this. If you get into the spot Bitcoin ETF, it's all about price appreciation and convenience. If you're into Bitcoin and self-custody and multi-sig solutions, you're in it for, I think, the real reasons, right? You're into it because it's decentralized, scarce, it's permissionless energy money. Like it's an amazing thing, but you have to do 100,000 hours, I think, of studying to really get to that point. And unfortunately, I think it may, I don't know that it will be wildly popular as time goes on. I think most people might just stick with the, we've seen from like throughout all of history, people just love convenience, right? They'll give up their rights. They'll give up freedom in order to have security and convenience. And so anyways, we'll see. I don't have a strong opinion, I guess, where that's going to go.
Fair enough. Yeah, I guess I kind of see it interesting as like, you know, financial advisors in general, they, like you kind of brought up, you know, most people are probably just better off just buying Bitcoin and like not even talking with the financial advisor, potentially if they're super deep into Bitcoin. But then, you know, as a financial advisor or someone that wants to be a financial advisor, you might want, like, you want to still make a living somehow. So maybe like you can provide that service of like holding a private key and like saying like, hey, like I can't control your Bitcoin, Unchained can't control your Bitcoin. You have access to your Bitcoin via one key, but you need one of us to help you move it. So maybe it's like a middle ground that like the financial advisors will be pushing over time. But like you said, maybe people will just opt for convenience of BlackRock, or if they're like super deep into Bitcoin, they'll just set up a multi-sig themselves and not even deal with an advisor.
And I think, Joe, what's fun about this, like I love where we are right now at this point in history. We're seeing this all brand new asset class come out and we're watching the infrastructure get built out in real time, you know, on the layer twos and layer threes and all these custody solutions. What's fun about it is like, I don't know where it's going to go. It's kind of like how the internet was maybe back in 1995. You could see the potential, but it was hard to predict exactly how it was all going to play out. And that's just where I think we are. I think the markets are going to decide, like maybe the model you're talking about where an advisor holds a key and Unchained holds the other key and they hold another key. You know, it's maybe that will really catch on. Maybe the markets will be like, yes, this is it. This is what the market wants. Or maybe it will just have a small niche. You know, there'll just be a small minority of people that want to do that. There's so many ways you can go with this and so many ways for the infrastructure to play out that I just think it's fascinating personally. And I love watching big macro trends and watching where the world is moving and trying to invest accordingly as well. But just it's just fascinating to watch. And I think the world is going to be so different 10 years from now that we're barely going to even recognize these early days of Bitcoin. I do think at some point we're going to, I was just thinking about this the other day, like, you know, the cold storage devices that are, you know, these little USB kind of things. I think at some point we're going to be like, can you believe we used to have like our Bitcoin seed phrase on this little USB port? Like, isn't that funny?
In this frontier moment, Dr. Jeff is explaining how we will likely look back decades from now and laugh at how we manage Bitcoin private keys today. In the future, it's possible that managing Bitcoin private keys could evolve far beyond anything we currently imagine. Maybe we will use technology similar to Neuralink to handle our private keys directly with our minds. This may mean embedding a tiny secure device within our neural circuitry, enabling us to control and authorize Bitcoin transactions through thought alone, meaning the private keys are in your brain and you can only sign a transaction if you truly want to, not if someone is forcing you to. This advancement would not only revolutionize security, but also make access to Bitcoin instant and intuitive. And now back to Dr. Jeff.
Because I think things will just change and it'll be so different. And I don't know how and I don't know why. But to me, it reminds me of how people make fun of the dial-up internet back in the 90s. That all those crazy noises and stuff. Like, that's what I grew up with. And it was really clunky. And just I used to like click on a picture and it would go line by line. And it would sometimes take like 3 minutes just to like download a picture of somebody. And like, man, that feels so, so archaic now. And I think that these early days of Bitcoin, where we have Bitcoiners actually moving Bitcoin on the base layer of Bitcoin and then, you know, holding our keys, I just think the world's going to change. And I think we're going to look back on these days and laugh at how like primitive it seemed. But that's my take.
I definitely agree with that. It's going to change a lot in ways that we probably can't even think about so far today.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of last topic, then we can probably go ahead and wrap it up. Post-hyper-Bitcoinization, do you think that Bitcoin somewhat replaces or effectively does replace like passive index funds, like buying the S&P 500 and holding it? Or do you think there's any place at all, like will that product still exist?
I think that what's happening is we're already starting to see a great reset in the prices of these other major asset classes. So Bitcoin is this new nascent asset that's basically starting to soak up purchasing power. And what we saw is this monetary premium that shouldn't have existed, I would argue, on lots of asset classes. Stocks, as you can quibble about, should it be there? Definitely not real estate, like people using houses as investments and flipping houses. To me, that's just insane. Like, we're going to look back at this time period and be like, I can't believe we lived through that. Like, that's not normal. It should be shelter for people. And I think housing should basically increase at the rate of population growth and shouldn't be seen as these great investment classes. You know, venture capital as well, and all these sort of things that have monetary premiums. Gold, I believe, has a monetary premium. And I think we're going to see that shrink over time. And so I think, though, at some point, right, we're always going to have businesses. I think we'll probably always have the ability to invest, at least in our lifetimes, in stocks, so in the equity of companies. But because they're so wildly overvalued, I think relative to Bitcoin, even today, even though they've gone down so much in Bitcoin terms for the first 15 years, I think they have much, much further to fall over time. And then I think at some point, say 15 years from now, 10, 15, 20 years from now, I think that the valuations on tons of companies, there's going to be lots of new businesses that we can't even imagine right now that are going to be out. They probably actually might be worth investing in and actually parting with some of your Bitcoin, because I think the CAGR, compounding annual growth rate of Bitcoin, 15, 20 years from now, will have come down enough that you'll be like, you know what? I think that this business could probably grow at a 30% CAGR for a decade. And I don't think Bitcoin is going to grow at a 30% CAGR, maybe by the year 2045 or so. So yeah, I do think value investing won't die, but I think it's going to have a massive reset. The closest analogy I can come to is, I think back in the late 60s, the Nifty 50 stocks, you couldn't lose. Everybody invested in them. They were the Kodaks and the McDonald's and the Disneys and all these companies and Coca-Colas. All you had to do is put money in it, and all they did is went up for years and years and years and years. It's similar to what we have today, I think, with the monopolies that are on the internet monopolies, basically, you know, the Apples and Amazons and Googles and those companies. I think that, and then what happened is from basically 1968 or so to about 1982, they basically chopped sideways and didn't go anywhere. And people lost total interest in stocks during that time period. I think we're at the start of that period now, where we're going to see this sort of sideways, choppy, not very good performance in real terms. We might see nominal gains, possibly. But I think when you factor in inflation, that they're basically not going to move anywhere for the next, say, 10, 15 years or so. And by the end of that, when people have forgotten about it and nobody cares about stocks anymore and value investing is dead, that's when it'll be time to get back in and become a value investor in businesses again. But, you know, 10, 15, 20 years from now, we're no time soon.
I agree with that as well. We talked about like the optimal portfolio allocation like today, which potentially could be, you know, very, very high in Bitcoin terms. Cold storage Bitcoin effectively. What do you think about post hyper Bitcoinization? Like, would then it would be like, you know, 80% value stocks or 20% Bitcoin? Or like, how would you think about trying to, you know, figure out what percentage should be in Bitcoin after hyper Bitcoinization?
I would say that most of the world's population won't even need to worry about anything other than just simply saving. I think the whole concept of investing in Wall Street and this entire huge, massive multi-trillion dollar marketplace that we have won't exist. I think that most people just be like, why would I do that? I'm just going to say, I just save in Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is just the money. And people are like, why would I put it in something else? And I have it as my savings. So even though I believe that growth will continue to slow down over time and volatility will eventually start to come in over time, that people are just going to use it as savings and people won't think about investments. People who like are investment advisors for a living won't exist, because they'll be like, what the heck would you do with an investment advisor for the most part? And I think that's awesome. And I think that's very good for humanity. I think the fact that most of the world can simply store their value, their purchasing power in an asset like Bitcoin, that's going to be ubiquitous, I believe, around the world, probably in, who knows, 15, 20, 30 years from now, that they don't have to do anything other than work hard, saving Bitcoin, stack sats, and just go about your business, and your money will take care of yourself. And you should have enough at that point to pay for yourself and your family and even for future generations. So I'm very optimistic about the future because of the capabilities of Bitcoin.
Yeah, I love it. Dr. Jeff, thanks so much for taking the time to sit down with me today.
Thanks for having me on your show, Joe. I always love being on here.
Yeah, great. Where can the audience go learn to find more about you or anything else you want to share them?
Sure. I mean, the easiest way is on X or Twitter.com. My handle is @BaleshireCap. I spend a lot of time there and I'm on Spaces. You can check out if you want. I run a hedge fund called Baleshare Partners, and you can check out baleshare.com if you're interested as well.
Sweet. Well, this was great. Thanks, Dr. Jeff.
Thanks so much.